Hi, podcast listeners. Lost in the Stacks broadcasts on WREK Atlanta from the campus of Georgia Tech every Friday at noon. Thanks for joining us through the internet. And if you have a moment, let us know how you found us, how you're listening, and what you like. We are always trying to improve and expand. Enjoy the show.
What do I want to see them for? What am I, in trouble?
Yes, Dr. Jones, we've heard a great deal about you.
Have you?
Professor of archaeology, expert on the occult, and how does one say it? Obtainer of rare antiquities.
That's one way of saying it. Why don't you sit down? You'll be more comfortable.
Thank you. Yes, you're a man of many talents.
I blame that pause on Audio Vault. It's supposed to clip the silence at the end of the files you put in there, Fred.
Maybe there wasn't exact silence. Maybe there was flapping of butterflies.
Silence ain't an exact silence with these guys. You are listening to WREK Atlanta, and this is Lost in the Stacks, the original research library rock and roll radio show. I am Charlie. My co-host is Amit.
Hey, everyone.
We both work at the Georgia Tech Library. Fred is on the board. Wendy and Adam are in the studio, and for the next hour, we've got music and library talk for you. Whichever you're here for, we hope you dig it.
Our show today is called The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu.
Are you even allowed to say that? There's a lot going on in that. Is this Dr. Jones and Fortune and Glory?
It's close. We'll be interviewing the author of a recently published nonfiction book called The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu. And yes, it does involve the story of, how does one say it? An obtainer of rare antiquities.
Is this going to get all Steven Spielberg-y? Because I would have brought the kids.
If you, our listeners, want to join the conversation, the hashtag for this show is LITS316 for Lost in the Stacks, episode 316.
Feel free to tweet your thoughts, reactions, and synonyms for badass with that hashtag in case you're uncomfortable with badass.
Oh boy, this is going to get rough.
And our songs today are filled with danger. Conflict, aggression, escape, all in the day's work for the badass librarians of Timbuktu. I really like saying that. They look at danger and stare it down with a fearless, steely gaze like a real-life John Wayne. So let's start with Cowboys in Africa by the Bush Tetras, right here on Lost in the Stacks. This is Lost in the Stacks, and joining us by phone from Berlin is Joshua Hammer, author of The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu. Joshua, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
For our listeners that may not be familiar with the book, could you describe a little bit about the story and how you came to know about this fascinating protagonist, really the hero of the tale, Abdel Kader Haidara? Why'd you write this book?
Sure. Yeah, good pronunciation. In a nutshell, the story focuses on this protagonist, Abdel Kader Haidara, who is a scholar and a librarian in the remote Malian village city, whatever you want to call it. It's about a 50,000 person town, let's call it, called Timbuktu, at the edge of the Sahara Desert. Haidara almost single-handedly revived the city, which was really kind of a moribund shell in the 1990s, and rediscovered this great tradition of manuscripts, intellectual tradition that had kind of reached its height in the 16th century. So he gathered up all of these manuscripts, tens of thousands of these ancient, beautiful, illuminated manuscripts ranging from Qurans to books about astronomy and medicine and history, pretty much rediscovered them, built libraries, turned Timbuktu back into the cultural center it was hundreds of years ago, and was kind of cruising along, very satisfied with his work, when Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, the North African branch of Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda, conquered the north of Mali in 2012, and began destroying all vestiges of multiculturalism, of tolerance, and set their sights on these glorious manuscripts. So Abdelkader Haider then undertook a really phenomenal, unprecedented smuggling operation to save these manuscripts that he had amassed from the clutches of Al-Qaeda by, as I said, a smuggling operation, secretly bringing them out of the city into the safety of government-held territory 600 miles south of Timbuktu.
You know, in the book, something that I think was really illuminating for me was just how vibrant Timbuktu was and is, but really how vibrant it was as an epicenter for learning, not unlike Alexandria and the Library of Alexandria. And most Western histories of Africa appear to ignore this fact. Certainly I was quite ignorant of just how incredibly rich and diverse Timbuktu was. Were you aware of this history prior to your research, prior to beginning the book?
Yeah, well, I was based in Africa as a foreign correspondent for Newsweek 20 years ago. And it was during that period that I made my first trip to Timbuktu. But I was drawn really by the name. I didn't know much more than the name. That it was a kind of a metaphor for end of the world, for an end of the world backwater, desert backwater. And I knew a bit about the fact that European explorers had journeyed there in the early part of the 19th century, having heard that the streets were paved with gold. I knew that there was myth surrounding the city. But I didn't know really until I went back to Timbuktu, like in 2006, where I first met Haider, that myth was based on fact, that in fact, 500 years ago, it was a city where gold was literally flowing in the streets. I mean, that was the main unit of transaction was gold. It was an incredibly wealthy city. It was a trading center that brought together goods from Europe, with traders from sub-Saharan Africa. They would meet in Timbuktu and exchange slaves and products from the rainforest with silk from England and Europe. And so you had this incredible, vibrant commerce going on, great wealth being generated, and at the same time you have this intellectual tradition being developed simultaneously. So it's really hard to imagine that 500 years ago, this really lost, godforsaken place in the middle of the edge of the Sahara Desert was one of the centers of the world. And that awareness gradually came upon me as I was as I got to know Haider, originally just writing an article about him for Smithsonian Magazine in 2006, and later even more so as I began to do the research for the book 8 years later.
He is such an interesting character because I think he was reluctant at first. If I recall, he wanted to go into business. And anyone that knows about librarianship knows this is not a money-making kind of endeavor.
To be sure.
What?
His father was both of these. His father was both a scholar and a businessman. And so Abdelkader was torn. You know, he was drawn to the scholarship of his father. His father had a big manuscript collection, which is how he first found out about this tradition. And he found it really alluring, and he learned to read Arabic when he was a kid and learned a bit about manuscript preservation. And basically, his father named him the curator of the family collection after his death, in the will that he would take over after his father's death. But as far as making this a career, you know, he really didn't have any desire to do it. He was more drawn to his father's the financial side of his father's life, the kind of wily businessman who had made a good deal of money in doing everything from trading grain to amassing real estate.
And do you think at what point did Haider believe that he was in it for the long haul, you know, so to speak, because there's a certain point of no return here where I don't think he was at any point he could just walk away from this project. It seemed like he was completely invested, but it took a while for that moment to happen.
Yeah, he was when he was a young man, I guess in his mid-20s, there was a government library that was funded by the royal families of Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. This government library in Timbuktu, the curator of that library really wanted to find somebody who could aggressively go out into the Malian countryside, the desert, the villages along the river, and track down a lot of these manuscripts that had been lost over the centuries. They'd been dispersed. Timbuktu had been conquered by Morocco in 1591 and had pretty much faded as a literary and commercial center. The books were dispersed. Families passed them down to many heirs. The libraries were kind of destroyed as well. So this guy wanted to revive this great tradition in Timbuktu, and he decided that Hyder was the right guy to do it. So he pretty much lured Hyder into it. He pressed him for almost a year, really twisted his arm, telling him he was the inheritor of a great tradition, that this was a job that only he could do, and kind of played to Hyder's pride and the family honor and the work that his father had done before him. And so Hyder eventually took the bait, and he started going out into the countryside and discovered very quickly that he was really good at it. He loved the adventure. He loved the tracking down these lost volumes, following clues, following leads, sometimes calling on connections that his father had made in his years, decades of travel. And I guess the more that he pursued this, the more he loved it. And within a couple of years, this was his métier. He had sort of given up any thoughts of going into business, and this became his life.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Joshua Hammer, author of The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu. And we'll be back with more from Joshua after music set.
And you can file this set under DT551.22.S73.
Mr. Greaves by the Pixies. Hope everything is all right. Before that, Survival of the Streets by the Cro-Mags. And we kicked the set off with A Line in the Sand by P.J. Harvey. Those were songs about those affected by aggression and attacks. Today's Lost in the Stacks is The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu. And we're talking to Joshua Hammer, the author, about his book recently published by Simon & Schuster. Joshua, in the last segment, we talked a little bit about the hero of this story, although I think there's probably many, many heroes. There was, you know, it was a big endeavor getting these manuscripts to safety. But the primary kind of protagonist, Hydra, one of my favorite pieces of the book is how he has to change his approach in trying to convince, people that he was going to take good care of this material, that he wasn't just going to sell the manuscripts. He was accused of that a few times. How did he build trust with the people that where he was trying to get these long-standing kind of manuscripts, to safety? What words did he use?
Yeah.
What techniques?
Well, first of all, he had the example, the sort of negative example of predecessors at that National Library that he was working for, who had tried to do what he had done. They'd gone out in big vehicles and teams of, six or seven guys with portable microfilm machines and generators for electricity when they were out in the bush. And that freaked people out, these kind of penniless villagers seeing these convoys come in. They were bewildered and kind of intimidated, and also figured these people were insanely rich. So those guys pretty much got nowhere. Abdul Qadir would go out, instinctively realized he had to create a very humble appearance. So he would go out on foot or on a camel, would show up alone, wearing very humble clothing, trying to present himself as somebody they could relate to. But even so, at the beginning, when he was offering cash, he always carried cash with him, and he would try to make these financial deals with people, and that put people off because these were family heirlooms, and the idea of exchanging them for cash struck many as repugnant and, and an insult. So that didn't do him very well. So gradually he learned that what would work best would be to create a barter system. For instance, he discovered that that a lot of these villagers who had collections really loved printed books. I mean, manuscripts, handwritten manuscripts were, you know, and some of these people were a dime a dozen in their view, whereas printed books, if you were a villager in the middle of some, you know, tiny desert oasis in the Sahara, printed books were the holy grail. So he would barter printed books that he'd get from publishers or bookshops in Algeria or wherever in Morocco, and trade them for these 400 or 500 year old handwritten volumes. And the villagers were always delighted to get those. He would also make deals trading livestock. He would offer people cows or camels. At one point, he built a school for a village, for the village chief, a mosque. So these kinds of deals were much more appealing to locals. And also, there were, people were just really suspicious about him. What he was up, was he just going to take these volumes and trade them, you know, to the, sell them to the highest bidder? Was he in this for profit? But gradually he managed to persuade them that, no, he was actually taking them to this manuscript center in Timbuktu where they would be carefully preserved and put on display. And villagers really appreciated that. I mean, the word got out that, hey, this guy is not a con man. He's not a a conniving businessman out for serving his own pecuniary interests. He was really dedicated to preserving these books and putting them on display for the world to see. And that really he worked his way into the good graces of people across the region.
When you learned about these strategies and how he did it seem analogous to anything else that you had heard about or read about, you know, elsewhere? Was this the same as something
else? I can't
else?
Really think of anything. I mean, this guy was one of a kind. I just you got something in mind, but for me, this was all this guy's story was unique. The setting was unique. I really, you know, I had to tease the details out of him. It was not easy. He's not a natural raconteur. But once you get him going, he was very proud of this work. It was clear. And once you got him going and expressed great interest in it, then the stories and the anecdotes really started pouring out of him. And it revealed this pursuit in this world that I really had never encountered anywhere else.
Could you describe just what makes these manuscripts so unique and so beautiful?
Yeah, I mean, I won't say they're all beautiful. Some of them are just an outside observer who can't read Arabic. You just see these kind of pages and pages of Arabic calligraphy, which is an attractive language, attractive script, but you know, it can be kind of deadening after the eye thread. But some of them, then you come across books that are, I would say, the equivalent of these Italian biblical manuscripts from the Renaissance, you know, handwritten by monks with these, except you don't have the same, the human visage is not allowed to be reproduced in Islam, so you don't get that, but you do get this magnificent gold leaf. You get these stunning geometrical designs that I've also encountered on certain, you know, medieval mosques and on some of the carpets that come out of the Arabic world, Islamic world. I mean, just magnificent magnificent patterns and geometrical designs that just kind of hypnotize you in their complexity and beauty. And the colors, the fact that some of these books are 500, 600 years old and they still have these luminescent colors embedded in them is remarkable. The leather, the goat or camel skin that was used, or sheepskin that was used to enclose the books. The covers are often beautiful. They're inlaid with turquoise or jade or other semi-precious stones. And sometimes you encounter these really beautiful representational art. Mosques, you know, of a pen and ink drawing of the great mosque of Mecca done in Medina, done 500 years ago. Landscapes. Representations of musical instruments in books about musicology, medicinal plants, you know, really intriguing, highly detailed, beautifully wrought pictorial imagery.
You're listening to Lost in the Stacks, and we're talking about the badass librarians of Timbuktu, by Joshua Hammer, and we'll talk more with Joshua on the left side of the hour.
Hey, this is Mike Jagerfalt. I'm a medical librarian in Stockholm, Sweden, and you're listening to Lost in the Stacks, WREK Atlanta. There's coffee, yo.
Lord knows it. Come. Scientific. It's nothing special about it all.
There is coffee, yo. Our show today is called The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu. Here are a few lines from Mr. Hammer's book. Encased in goatskin covers with inlaid semi-precious stones, they were gorgeous works, composed by the most skillful scribes of the era, fragile pages covered with dense calligraphy and complex geometrical designs in a multitude of colors. I pictured a robed scribe dipping his quill pen into a leather pouch filled with illuminated ink, huddled over linen paper in a murky, I don't know how to say this word, atelier? Okay. I don't even know what that is. Back to the words. Of a university in 16th century Timbuktu, these artifacts celebrated the sensual and the secular, and they bore the explicit message that humanity, as well as God, was capable of creating beauty. They were monumentally subversive. All right, well, let's just hang with that for a minute. File this set under HV6433.M628B96.
Yeah! Now just show your dread, come from your heart fully, you know where I mean.
That was When All Else Fails by Savage Republic, who I'd never heard. No, wait, it was not. That was MPLA by Tapazuki, and before that was When All Else Fails by Savage Republic, which I had never heard before, and is now, I think, one of my favorite bands. Maybe. Those were songs about armed conflict with militants.
Welcome back. We're talking about the badass librarians of Timbuktu on Lost in the Stacks. And our show today is all about the thrilling and true story of heroism under incredibly trying and dangerous circumstances. Our guest is author Joshua Hammer. Joshua, you served as the Africa Bureau Chief for Newsweek. I have to acknowledge, I personally love the title. You don't often see librarians.
I do too. I wish I could claim credit for it, but I owe my editor.
It's great. As the bureau chief, I'm sure you saw many of the tensions that arose during your time there. Just where did those tensions and that danger interact with the badass librarian?
Well, in Algeria, which I actually didn't cover as a Newsweek bureau chief, but you had a civil war going on in the 1990s, where radical Islam really first appeared in that region. And then it kind of it trickled down to the Sahara. Algeria is the bordering country with Mali. So after the radical Islamists sort of didn't win in Algeria, but they became a very violent, powerful force. They moved down after this, as this war wound down, into the north of the country and began radicalizing local people. You also had the Saudis and their Wahhabi Islam, which is the radical Islam of Al-Qaeda, coming into that region. They built mosques. I remember in 2006, when I was in Timbuktu for the second time, somebody pointed out to me this giant Saudi-built mosque that was that had risen at the edge of the city that was attracting some of the youth. So you could see the tensions coming in. This was not the kind of Islam that the people of Timbuktu embraced. They were much more laid back and mystical and into dancing and singing and didn't really want to impose a religion on people. So you had this new conservative, even radical strain coming in. Everything kind of came to a head during the Arab Spring when Gaddafi fell from power and was later killed. The armories of Libya were thrown open in the chaos. The radical Islamists came in, grabbed the weapons, and then basically moved back into Mali and seized the country with their new weapons. Seized the north of the country, an area the size of France, with all these new weapons. So you had basically three really bad dudes, two Algerians, and one kind of nomadic Tuareg who embraced radical Islam, joined forces, and with maybe about 1,000, between 1,000 and 2,000 fighters, all heavily armed with these weapons from Gaddafi's arsenals, quickly seized control of the north of the country and began carrying out Sharia law and doing other nasty things in Timbuktu.
And so what was the specific danger to the manuscripts and to the librarian that came from these forces?
Well, at first the librarians were worried about looting. Timbuktu became chaotic. There was no law. There was no police. They had all fled. No military. The radicals were running the show. They didn't know what was going to happen. When the chaos kind of settled down, a bit of order began to be imposed by the radicals. But then the locals perceived a new threat, which was that the books themselves, because they embraced so many themes, because they showed this kind of multicultural, inclusive, tolerant style of Islam that was open to, you know, the Greek philosophers and sciences, and there were even manuals about sex, love poetry. The librarians and others in Timbuktu feared that at some point the manuscripts, the radicals were going to get these manuscripts in their sights and destroy them for many reasons. So it became imperative to them to hide them, and then as things got even worse in that part of in that city, to get them out of the city entirely.
You know, one of the perhaps less heroic but still heroic people or groups in this book are the foundations, the Ford Foundation, the Mellon Foundation, who were providing some of the resources to save these manuscripts, and even a Kickstarter to help get these things out, which I just found so. I can imagine the ask on Kickstarter that would catch my attention.
Yeah, I mean, the money was coming in from everywhere. The Europeans, the Dutch kicked in a couple hundred grand, a foundation in Dubai, a couple of foundations, as you point out, in the U.S., Kickstarter. And it just kind of showed the universal appeal, really the cross-cultural appeal of these manuscripts. Yes, they were in Arabic and some of them were Islamic, but a lot of people did respond to the idea of saving this country's patrimony, and partly because it showed a culture that was really embraced, somehow managed to fuse religious and secular ideas, and showed the two could be interrelated, could coexist, as they did in Timbuktu, and that is what really threatened these jihadists and made them determine, especially towards the end of their occupation, to destroy whatever they could get their hands on.
Well, we only have a minute left, but I'd like to ask you if you have a favorite manuscript. I imagine that you had many opportunities to flip through them yourself. Is there one that really stands out?
Well, I remember back in 2006 when Abdelkader arranged for me to travel up to this desert village, like 60 miles north of Timbuktu, and I walked into this shack that had become a library in this Berber, the Tuareg village, and this guy picked up this book from the 16th century and was showing me, you know, these incredible drawings. I mentioned some, the Mosque of Medina. I can't even remember what the book was about, but I was just so amazed to see these vibrantly colorful images in the margins of these texts, done with probably pen and ink, earth colors, dyes, and just exquisite pictorial representations of a world, of a now lost world, but all suddenly brought to vibrant life there in this book that was just, you know, I was one of maybe six people in the last 500 years to have set my eyes on it. So there was something just really, really special and emotional about seeing that object of beauty hidden away in the middle of nowhere.
That's wonderful. Well, we really enjoyed speaking with you, Joshua. This is a fascinating, fascinating book. I raced through it. I could not put it down.
Thanks. I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah, we've been speaking with Joshua Hammer today about his book, The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu. Joshua, thanks so much for being on the show.
You're very welcome, and thank you for having me.
File this set under Z659.H22.
City of Refuge by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and before that, Desolation Angel by the Eyes of Fate, songs about escaping destruction and finding hope.
Charlie, what is going on at the library next week?
We are going to repel foreign invaders. No, library classes will get you where you need to be. Patent searching, EndNote citation management, even Photoshop. Whether you're gritting your way through something mundane or entering the realm of the sublime, we are the Georgia Tech Library, and we are at your service.
And the Stacks is a collaboration between WREK Atlanta and the Georgia Tech Library. It is produced by Amit Dashi, Charlie Bennett, Wendy Hagenmeyer, and Fred Frasco.
That was Adam reading the credits. Josh is on the board today, and it's his first time doing it, which is why we had a little bit of... Fred, would you call that catastrophe or confusion?
I would call that handled with plum and grace.
Yeah. Pressure under grace under pressure, grace under fire. Our show was brought to you today by 1,000 years of history, so everything's cool.
Legal counsel and a leather pouch filled with illuminated ink were provided by the Burris Intellectual Property Law Group in Atlanta, Georgia.
Special thanks to Joshua for being on the show, to Simon and Schuster for arranging the interview, to all those saving precious works from destruction. And thanks, as always, to each and every one of you for listening.
You can hear this show again or get in touch with us at WREK.org/lostinthestacks. And you can find our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and many other podcast aggregators. Let us know if we're not on your preferred platform.
Next week on Lost in the Stacks, it's, I don't know, something about an archivist, something about trouble.
It's time for our last song today, and for the librarians and archivists listening, don't think that you have to dodge bullets and bombs as part of your job in order to be badass. Being a librarian at any level is pretty awesome. And it just so happens that this Research Library Rock and Roll Radio Show has your theme song, Because I'm Awesome by the Dolly Rots, right here on Lost in the Stacks. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Lost in the Stacks from WREK Atlanta and the Georgia Tech Library. Find us online at WREK.org/lostinthestacks to see playlists for old shows, connect with our social media, or get in touch with us.